Okay, so tonight we begin, we've had a little bit of a layover from our last Great Controversies in Jewish History course. This is section three. We're going to be dealing with four different controversies that affected the land of Israel, the modern state of Israel, the return to the land of Israel over the last 100 years or so. We actually did the first in this series at the end of last year. I'm going to review briefly a few of the things from that. Tonight's class is the fight over the soul of the land, the fight over the religious nature, over the land of Israel and the people of Israel between Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who of course will become the first chief rabbi, which we will discuss, of pre-state Israel. He dies in 1935, so he dies before, 13 years before even the state of Israel is born in the form that we know it together. His conflict with Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who was the leader of the religious community of Yerushalayim at the time. One disclaimer before we start. The disclaimer is that this controversy really is such that it's impossible to understand that which is taking place still today, 100 years later, in the state of Israel, in the religious conflict that exists, which you're all familiar, there's a conflict in Israel right now, right? It's complicated over there. You cannot really understand it without understanding the beginnings, the origins of that, which is what we're going to be discussing tonight. But the real disclaimer is that it's impossible to even try and express in depth this conflict in the hour or so that we're going to have. Rav Cook himself was such a complex, complicated, brilliant person, and to describe his just personal background in philosophy and all of the things that came up in an hour or so is a joke. It's impossible, so we're going to be scratching the surface. If some things seem a little bit simplistic, it's simply because there's so much to cover just to give a flavor and a taste. So I'm apologizing in advance, but I hope that we'll get that flavor, even though this topic is so much bigger. But it's a fascinating topic and one that I personally love. I think it's just absolutely fascinating. So let's begin. Number one, again, as I mentioned, both Rav Cook and Rav Sonnenfeld, we're talking pre-Holocaust and pre-state, which means that for us living now already towards the end of 2017, the state has existed for as long as I can remember. I can't even remember a time when the state didn't exist. This is pre-Holocaust, so it's a day, it's an age, it's an era that is nearly impossible to put ourselves back in understanding what it was like to live in the land of Palestine, even before it was British controlled. We're still under the Turks and the Ottoman Empire, and the Jews are coming back, and they're creating a land, they're creating a culture, they're creating their own society, but it's not theirs, and there's a battle for the nature, the spiritual nature, but it's before the state, so it's hard to keep that in mind as we go through, that the Jews are actually still visitors, so to speak, in a land that's not theirs. They're not the ruling party in the time frame that we're in, and the waves of Aliyah are beginning. We discussed already the late 1800s, early 1900s, it begins, but that's the time frame that we're in. What we discussed the last class, which I'm going to very briefly just go with that one parable that we described to try to understand it, is there was already a religious community living in the land of Israel, living in Yerushalayim. Rav Sonnenfeld himself arrives in Yerushalayim in 1873. So he's already, by the time 1900 rolls around, the World Zionist Congress, the first one in 1900, he's already been a 25-year veteran of this is our city. We've been a religious community here doing our thing for a long time, and now you begin to have these waves of Zionists, which again, today we might all identify ourselves as Zionists. The early Zionists were anti-Torah, anti-religious, socialists. They weren't interested in God. They weren't interested in tradition. And they begin these waves of immigration to start a national homeland. That's the political movement that they have begun. The parable that we described, I'm going to say it in brief because it's going to really be reflective of what we're talking about tonight. If you remember when we discussed it a couple months ago, the prince who's exiled by his father, the king, because he's not ready to take over the kingdom, and he's sent into exile for a bit of training. And the king sends him off and says, "When I call for you, I'm going to bring you back, and I'm going to have a beautiful bride waiting for you. She's going to be beautiful on the outside and beautiful on the inside. She's going to be capable and intelligent and talented, and she's going to help you rule this country. Just you wait till when I call for you." A couple of years go by. The prince out in exile gets a knock on the door from one of the king's servants. "Your father is deathly ill. Come quick and see him before he dies." Prince runs back, but it's too late. his father has passed away. He finishes his period of mourning, and there's a knock on his palace door, and a very unseemly, unsightly woman comes in and says, "Your father appointed me to be your bride." And the prince takes a look at her, and she is not just unattractive on the outside, she is incapable of anything. She is not talented, she is not capable, she's nothing. And you're the prince. You have a couple of ways to respond to this. One is to throw her out as an imposter and to say, "Well, my father gave me a promise. I don't know how you knew even to say this to me. It's a little odd. But as odd as it is that you came in here and said this, you're not it. Because this is what I was promised, and you're really nice and all. You're not it." And if I believe that, the prince would actually not just not take her in, he would throw her out as an imposter. "Who do you think you are? How dare you try to pretend to become my bride? You're an imposter," and you throw her out. That's one approach. There's another approach that says, the middle ground would say, "Listen, it's weird that you knew to say that. That's strange. I don't know what to do with that. But geez, doesn't it make any sense? I'll tell you what. I'll give you a room in the palace. I'm not going to marry you. I'm not ready to do that. Let's see what happens. You'll live here for a little bit. I'll set you up with some tutors. Maybe my father saw something in you that I don't really see. Let's see what happens. If over time it works, great. If not, I'll move you along, but I'm not going to marry you." And there's a third approach that says, if that's what my father wants, father knows best, and you marry the girl. Yeah? So this is what happened to the religious Orthodox community in the beginning of the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement was founded by anti-Torah Jews. The Jews have been waiting for 2,000 years. They've been praying. They've been mourning on Tisha B'Av. They've been saying their end of the Pesach Seder, L'shana Habab Yerushalayim. They have a vision from the prophets of what the redemption is going to be like. And that redemption is filled with miraculous stories and unbelievable events and miracles. And who shows up? Anti-Torah, anti-religious, atheist, socialists who are willing to go to Uganda? This doesn't make any sense. And so there were a couple of approaches. Some of the Jews, as there are few today, much fewer than were then, said, "This is an imposter. This is bad for the Jewish people because it's not the deal. This is not what our prophets told us to look for. And therefore, get rid of this. Do not associate with it. Everything about this is wicked and evil and wrong." And then there was a middle ground that said, "I don't know, this doesn't make any sense. Well, let's just sort of see what happens. We'll live in the land a little bit. Maybe things will change, will develop, I don't know." And then you have the approach, which is the approach of Rav Kook, which is, marry the girl. If this is what God ordained, doesn't make any sense to me, but let's go with it. And we're going to see that philosophy. That's a very difficult philosophy to live by because it didn't make any sense. Taking that parable just another step, there's another example that I've used many times in different contexts. I'm going to say it again now because it's very applicable. If you were to take a person out to the Empire State Building in New York, and you put them on the ground floor and say, "Paint me a picture of what you see looking out of the ground floor." So what picture would they paint looking out of that ground floor? So you would have calves in the street and people walking by, and you'd see the building across the street, and you'd only see the doorway of the building across the street. If you take a person three stories up and you'd say, "Paint me a picture of what do you see looking out the window?" So it's a different view from three stories up. You don't see the calves on the street because you're a little bit too high and you can't really see across. You'd see across the street a little bit more, and you see a little bit more of the buildings across. And that's it. If you take him 50 stories high and say, "Paint me a picture, what do you see?" He'd paint you the picture of New Jersey. And you wouldn't see anything about the street or the building on it. You'd pass that. Which one is right? Right? It's a trick question. It's a silly question. I mean, which one is right? It depends where you're standing. If I were to ask each one of those three people, say, "Is it permissible to jump out the window if you were afraid of a fire?" Well, if you're standing on the ground floor, you say, "I don't understand the question. We need to jump out the window. Just walk outside. Why are you asking me that? I don't even understand what you're talking about." If you're on the third floor, you'd say, "Jump out the window." You really shouldn't jump out of a third story window. But if it's a shas hadchak, if it's a very dangerous time and you really no other option, it's okay. If you're on the 50th floor, you would say, it doesn't matter how bad the fire is, just fight the fire, try to get down. Because going the other way, there's only one net result to going the other way. So everything is better than that. In a spiritual term, we all stand on different places. Different generations and different people within generations stand, occupy different spiritual floors, so to speak, when they look out in the world. And based on your perspective, you see the world very differently. Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel argue throughout the Gemara. They're looking at something, just looking at it from different angles. And when you see from different perspectives, based on where you're standing, you give a different response, whether or not something is permissible or not permissible. Sometimes you hear the answer, you really shouldn't, but if you have to, you can. Well, that's standing on the third floor. Some people say, I don't even understand what you're asking, just go right ahead. And others say, it's forbidden, don't ever do it, it won't work. It just depends on where you are. And every generation has to follow the psak of their generation's rabbis and leaders, because that generation's seeing things the way that their generation is. And it's just a different perspective. What we're going to learn about tonight, Rav Kook, we're going to study. Rav Kook saw the world from a different perspective than his colleagues. Not to say right or wrong, just to say fundamentally different way of understanding the world around. It would be analogous to, and this with this final introduction, we'll move into the actual story here. The first person to use an MRI, first doctor to use a sonogram, an x-ray, an MRI, you're seeing something that all of your colleagues can't even imagine seeing. To us, it's already standard. You can see inside the body. But imagine if you were a doctor up until the point where all you saw was the outside. That's all you had to go with. Whatever symptoms manifest themselves. And I can't see inside. And then all of a sudden, somebody comes along and, I can actually see what's going on. And then you start prescribing treatments fundamentally different than all your colleagues. And your colleagues look at you and they say, what are you doing? These symptoms you always treat like this. And you would say, I know, but I actually see what's going on inside. And therefore, I'm going to treat differently. If your colleagues can't see what you see, they always will look at you like you're crazy. Because they don't see what you're seeing. Rav Kook was a Kabbalist. He was brilliant. But he saw the world through a redemptive Kabbalistic lens. And because he saw the world through that lens, he perceived the process of Geula, of redemption, taking place, and we had to relate, the Jews of the land of Palestine pre-state, had to relate to that as if we are actually in a process. I want to read a quote from Orot, which was his he published over 50 books and innumerable articles and essays and journals. But let's read his words in the first box. If at a certain time there should be found an arousal within the Jewish people, whereby people will speak only of the spirit of the nation and will attempt to negate the spirit of God from all their assertions and from their revealed sources, which is their natural spirit, and disregard the Torah. Complicated. Let's go back. Rav Kook is going to address the question, how can it be that we now have a group of Jews, the Zionists, who are going to found the state, who are going to push for a national homeland, and what do they talk about as a body of Jews? They don't talk about God. They don't talk about Torah. How do they identify? This national movement, this idea of becoming a people, and in doing so, they totally disregard 2,000 years of history. Irrelevant. But we're a people. We're a nation, and we're going to become a nation. So he says, Rav Kook, what should be if there should be an arousal within the Jewish people? It's an amazing thing. He looks at it from a philosophical, what does it mean? Whereby they speak only of the spirit of the nation. All they talk about is a nation, a nation, a nation, we're going to be a people. And they attempt to negate the spirit of God. And they disregard the Torah. What should the righteous of such a generation do? How should the religious community respond, says Rav Kook, to this group of Jews who only talk about the nation and disregard Torah? What should our response be? So, we know what most of the Jews responded. How did the religious community respond in general? They said, this is treif. And the reality was, if you're looking from a kashrus perspective, from a Shabbos perspective, it was. Says Rav Kook, to rebel against the spirit of the nation, How can a religious Jew rebel against this movement represents the spirit of our people? To rebel, even verbally, to reject that which it asserts, that is something impossible. Why? The spirit of the Lord and the spirit of the Jewish people are one. You have to appreciate how radical what we're reading is right now. He is describing that if it is such that the national movement of the Jewish people is secular Zionism to return to the land and build a state, you can't reject that because the spirit of Hashem and the spirit of His people are one. And if this is what the people are doing, then that must be a reflection of what Hashem wants. Rather, therefore, the righteous must work hard to reveal the light and the holiness which lies in this national spirit, the light of God which lies within the light of Israel. Now, this is literally a radical idea that the people of his time looked at and said, are you kidding? All we want to do is try to create Shabbos and Kashrus and Mikvos and schools and yeshivas. And these people, these Jews, are coming in here and trying to wipe away everything. And we're fighting them so that we can keep our standards of Kashrus and Shabbos and everything. And you're telling us that they're the Spirit of God? Says Rav Kook, yes. Because the spirit of the people, of the Jewish people, and the spirit of the Lord are one. And if this is what they're doing, then you have to join in. His son writes, we quoted this at the end of last session that we had together, also says, how can it be that this movement did not originate with the religious? He asks it as a question. Why is this not happening through the religious Jews? How is it that some religious spokesman even withheld their support? He says, they fail. This is the son of Tzvi Yehuda Kook. They failed to recognize that it was not we mortals who were forcing the end, but rather the master of the house, the Lord of the universe, was forcing our hand. That it was not human voices that broke down the wall separating us from our land, but the voice of the living God calling upon us, go up. Na'aleh. So that was a perspective that everything that's happening is divinely inspired. This is what the father wants. Marry the girl. Now, this is difficult to explain and even more difficult to understand and sell to the masses because, again, it's not a religious group of people. The Ger Rebbe came and he met with Rav Kook because the Hasidim were beginning to move. Lots of people were moving to the land of Palestine at the time. So the Ger Rebbe came to meet with him and he wrote a letter to his Hasidim afterwards. And he used a parable that the Talmud itself uses. The Gemara says that Rebbe Meir, one of the Tanoim in the Gemara, one of the sages of the Talmud, was brilliant, head and shoulders above all of his colleagues. But we don't paskin like Rebbe Meir. When Rebbe Meir argues with the other sages, we paskin like the other sages, not like Rebbe Meir. The Gemara asks, if he was so brilliant, if he was so head and shoulders above everybody else, how come we don't hold like him? Why don't we should act in accordance with Rebbe Meir. Says the Gemara, he was so smart, lo yored chaverav lesof taito. His colleagues could not understand him. They just couldn't make head. He would say things, and it didn't make sense to them. It just didn't fit in the worldview that they had. Whatever Meir was saying, it didn't make any sense. So they would say to him, we know you're brilliant, but I can't understand what you're saying, so I can't follow it, because I can't act in accordance with something that I don't get. So we don't hold like him. So the Ger Rebbe said to his Hasidim, that's Rav Kook. This man is brilliant, and he's got a lens on the world. He's seeing things from the 50th floor. He's seeing a whole process flower and unfold in front of us. But it doesn't make any sense. We can't live like this. So we can't follow him, even though he has a perspective that's just deeper and more complicated than whatever we can figure out. Rav Zonnenfeld represents the real life in front of you right here, right now. We have to build a society. We have a whole community. He's been here again since 1873. By the time 1903 rolls around, he's been in Yerushalayim for 30 years. By the time Rav Kook comes to Yerushalayim in 1920, he's been there 50 years. He's an old, venerable, long, white-bearded Rav. And the Zionists are nothing more than a threat to the traditional life that they've had in Yerushalayim for 60, 70 years. And Rav Kook comes and says, we need to partner with them because they represent the spirit of the Lord. And Reb Zonnefeld represents, this is an imposter. This can't be redemption, because redemption doesn't look like this. Redemption is supposed to be exalted. It's supposed to be holy. It's supposed to be frum. It's supposed to be Shabbos and Kashrus, and this is not. And hereby we're going to have a major class between these two giants in the land, pre-state, pre-Holocaust, between how do we address this new world that's being forged by secular Zionists. How do we deal? How do we relate? And how do we combine that? A few words of background on Rav Kook. First of all, brilliance. Absolutely. From 1865 to 1935. Brilliant, brilliant scholar. He was a Kabbalist. He was a poet. He was a sensitive soul. He was prone to tears. His poetry is brilliant. There's really no way to describe, other than through some of the stories that we'll share tonight, the sheer brilliance. He was complicated. He came from a mixed background. His parents, his mother's family were Chabad Hasidim, and his father's side were very strong Mitnagdim, which we studied about in the past. So he had this a Litvak as a father, a Chassid as a mother, and a Kabbalist as a son, and he sort of combined in his brilliance everything and just synthesized them into one seamless whole of all that the Litvaks took in terms of learning and all the Hasidim and all the Kabbalah. All of it just was combined. On top of that, his parents believed that the redemption was on hand and taught him to speak Hebrew as a young child. So you have this mixed bag of Hasidus, Kabbalah, Litvak, learning, Hebrew, all in a brilliant mind that comes around once in a lifetime. When we think of him as the first chief rabbi of Israel, as some type of Zionist, he didn't look the part. He was not wearing sandals and a little atemba on his head. He looked as traditional can be. He was trained in the classical yeshivas of Volozhin. He writes about himself that when he was there, he arrived at 19. In three years, at the height of his learning, he would learn 60 blot a day. 60 blot is a double-sided page of the Gemara. And he was learning 60, I can tell you, it's not just speed reading, I can guarantee that. 60 blot a day for 3 years. Over a 5-year period, he finished Shas, the entire 2,711 pages of the Talmud, 17 times over that 5-year period. There was an element of brilliance, of scholarship that carried him throughout his entire life, and that nobody could question. Whether or not the religious world questioned his ideals, his philosophy, 100%. And they questioned him, not just they questioned him, they banished him, they burned him, they put him in cherem, they held him, he was off the deep end. But his being a Talmud Chacham was unquestioned. He was the type of guy, he's the type of tzaddik who would wear his tefillin all. He spent decades wearing his tefillin all. Now, we don't wear our tefillin because we can barely handle our tefillin for the 35 minutes of Shacharis in the morning. Barely. And I say barely because we're supposed to not talk when we're wearing our tefillin. We're supposed to only have pure thoughts when we're wearing our tefillin. We can't even do it for 35 minutes a day. So, but we should be wearing tefillin all day long. And he did. For decades. He went to the mikveh every day. His enemies said on him, Halavai, we... This is the enemies, meaning his Haredi religious world. Halavai, we should daven on Yom Kippur the way he davens on a regular Tuesday. Halavai, we should get to such a level to be that pious and that our davening of Yom Kippur should look like a regular Tuesday for him. So there was a recognition of who we are. Again, the philosophies, there were those who thought that he was off the deep end. But in terms of his piety and his scholarship, his poetry, it was all there. He arrives in Israel for the first time in Yaffa. He was the chief rabbi of the city of Yaffa in 1904. He already had been a rav in a couple of different places in Europe. As things would have it, he traveled to a convention in 1914, an Aguda convention in Switzerland, and the war broke out. The First World War broke out. And he was stranded outside of the land of Israel for 5 years. from 1915 until 1919. He spent two of those years as a Rav in Switzerland. He couldn't get back to the land of Israel during the war years. And then he spent 3 years in England. And he was in England in 1917 in London for the Balfour Declaration. And he saw that as part of this divine plan of redemption, that he should merit to literally be in London for the Balfour Declaration, was all part of this picture that he had. And he was able to get back. He became the rabbi of Jerusalem when he returned in 1990. He was invited to be the rabbi of Jerusalem in 1919. He eventually accepted in 1921, which is a whole story into itself. But a little bit of the background. Very heavily influenced by both the Netziv, who was the head of the yeshiva in Volozhin, of Tel Aviv Yehuda Berlin, and the Chafetz Chaim, both of whom who saw redemption, like right there. We were on the cusp of redemption, and he was very influenced by that. And then he lived through the development of the land of Israel. His philosophy, bottom of page one. Everything is based on a historical process. Now, this is, again, a meek effort of a philosophy that's so much larger than anything I could really wrap my mind around personally. Everything is based on a historical process, and all existence is in a state of divine becoming. Things are becoming. They're developing. The enemy of good is constriction, is being small, is being in exile. Good, we're supposed to be moving out. Like, the universe is expanding, the world is expanding, life is expanding, the Jews are expanding. We're coming closer to God. Exile is being constricted. That's being small, and everything bad in the world is being tiny. We want to be expansive. So you have the exile of the Jew. There are two exiles, the Jew from the land of Israel and humanity from God. Those are the exiles that the world is going through. So the Jew needs to return to Israel, and in so doing, he will return all of humanity to its proper place in its relationship with God, which we spoke about last night, for those who are at the class of the Jew being the Kohen to the world, of bringing the entire world back to that place of where it should be. And therefore, we celebrated progress in the development as the deepest expression of divinity. Now, you remember, we spent many weeks discussing the Enlightenment, when we talked about all the controversies in Jewish life in the 1800s that all surrounded the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was this movement of progress, of moving forward, of breaking the shackles of religion in the secular world, classes, just allowing it, moving forward. And you see that and hear that in this expanse. This was a fulfillment of many of those ideas. And he combined it with a lot of Kabbalistic ideas. In order to achieve redemption, the forms of exile have to be broken. There's this Kabbalistic idea we've spoken about, which is very in brief, which is all that I understand it, the idea of a husk or a shell, that there are sparks of holiness that are covered by a husk or a shell of impurity, and you need to break the husk in order to allow that spiritual light out. And the Jew in exile is surrounded by all of these husks and in these lands that are filled with all of these husks, and it's our job to break them through. In a parable that he uses, similarly, if you have a seed, contained within that seed is the future of that plant, the next generation, so to speak. When you put the seed in the ground, what happens to it? So the seed has to break down and disintegrate in order for the next generation to germinate from it. In the dark depths underground, it has to be buried, and only when it's buried and it breaks down and decomposes in a sense, then from that, the next, Tzemach David Abdecha, the sprouting forth of redemption. So if Cook looked at the Jewish people and Jewish history as that, we need to be broken and buried, and then from that will grow the next generation, the flowering of the redemption. And that's all of Jewish history. He asked the question in number three on your sheet. How is it that after 1,000 years of religion, that the vessels of religion has been broken in the modern world? He was bothered by this question. For 1,500 years, the dominating force in world history, was religion. From paganism to Christianity to Islam, there was always, religion was at the center of everything. And all of a sudden in the 1700s, there's this mass rebellion from the Enlightenment, and everybody throws religion away. And the Jews, of course, were swept up with that as well. And Rav Kook asked, philosophically speaking, how is that? How can it be that religion dominates world history for so long, and then, like, poof, all of a sudden everybody throws it away? So he saw in that the planting of the seed. Religion, which was the seed which carried the Jewish people for 2,000 years. But now at the very end, you've been carrying the seed. When it's finally time to plant, what do you do with that seed? You've been holding it for so long, waiting for this, for winter to end. Oh, finally now, you bury it. Yeah, that's what you do. And it's like religion's been carrying the sparks of spirituality throughout all of world history, and now it's time to plant. And what do you do when you plant? So you have to bury it. And they all of, so like the world like buried religion, all so that eventually it can sprout through. Let's read. It's a little bit of a long quote, but it's worth reading. In the middle of page 2, as long as the nation has no need, our nation of the Jews, has no need to correct its practical approach to life while in exile, the impurities in understanding of divinity. While we're in exile, we have a lot of misunderstandings about the divine. It's not perfect. Says Rav Kook, it doesn't matter. While you're in exile, we're not running a show. We're just visitors in a strange land. It's literally about survival. Exile is survive, survive, survive. What are we waiting for? To go home. When we go home, then it'll be the right way. So it says, as long as you're in exile, okay, you have certain impurities as a nation, you have certain impurities in your understanding, it doesn't really matter. It does no visible damage. However, says Rav Kook, when the time arises in which the national renaissance is necessary and the horn of salvation must be revealed, then those impurities which existed within us impede any outbursts of holiness. Then we need to fix everything. Well, what's that time of the national renaissance? Says Rav Kook, we're living in it. We're rebuilding, we're reforming, we're returning to the land. And it's impossible for the nation to bond together and achieve in its life its strength and implantation of its order. And with clear thinking, we need deeds that proceed from the purity of pure knowledge of God with the utmost clarity. And that's why now, in the footsteps of the Mashiach, this is why the atheists exist with great... Why are there so many atheists right now, he says. Even though it's terrible to see such awful things, so much truth, good qualities, laws and customs that were treasured by Jews, swept away and uprooted by a flood of negativity. It's horrible, he says, to watch this. 2,000 years of Jewish history was just thrown away by the secular Zionists. Despite this, eventually, all will grow in purity and strength and supernatural holiness from the firm, pure, exalted kernel which no negativity can affect. And then, when all is broken, the light will shine as new upon Zion with a wondrous greatness. See, he sees in this a part of the process. This is the part of the breaking down of the Jewish people which will eventually flower. But all of this negativity and the throwing away of traditions, it's all part of that process. And therefore, Zionism was far more than a political movement or a safe haven to protect us. He saw it as the catalyst of human evolution. And by ending their exile, their spiritual genius will be freed, bringing redemption to the world. This is an approach. Now, I can tell you again, as I have mentioned already, the rest of the religious community did not see in the secular Zionists the herald of the Mashiach that were going to bring about the spiritual light, and that they were just a step in the process. All they saw was a danger to their children. That's what they saw. If my children see this, they will do this, and then they won't be religious anymore. And that's a threat. So that's all they saw. Threat, danger. And Rav Kook sees in them the footsteps of Mashiach. Now we can get into some of the controversies. Okay, the first one is the one that we've really been discussing, which is Zionism itself. Rav Kook believed that the Jewish return was part of the messianic process of redemption, and therefore saw everything in this context. His phrase that he coined was, renew the old and sanctify the new. It's a brilliant phrase, renew the old, because what did the Zionists want? They wanted to throw away the old. The old was a old, hunched over, short Jew with a crooked nose, and a short, low back, and uneducated, and he wasn't part of the world, and said, we don't want that anymore. We want a 6 foot tall, blonde hair, blue eyed, strong farmer who's going to create a society and be good at sports and take his place amongst the nation. It's a new Jew. Shabbos, we don't need that anymore. So Rav Kook said, no, we're going to renew the old. We're going to renew it. It was old, and it needs to be renewed. and we're going to sanctify the new. All this new stuff, all these new people, the new Jews coming in, that needs to be sanctified. So we're going to renew the old and sanctify the renew the old and sanctify the new.
Sounds very Chabad.
I mean, he was a descendant of Chabad. It's Kabbalistic, it's Hasidic, and it's with a redemptive view. He's standing on the 50th floor, looking out and seeing everything unfold in front of him and saying, this is a process and we have to embrace the process. The girl doesn't look like what my father promised, but if this is what God did, then this is what God wants. And if this is what God wants, embrace it and sanctify it. Now, nobody else saw things this world, and he was opposed on every single side. For example, even the Zionist, Ben Yehuda himself, the father of our modern Hebrew language, who championed the Uganda appeal, he called out all of his secular Zionists to task, and he said, you guys are all hypocrites. When the idea of Uganda came up, and everybody said, no, only Palestine. And Ben Yehuda got up and he said, you're all hypocrites, because if you're going to turn your back on all of our history, which we're all doing, then what's the difference between the land of Palestine and Uganda? We just need a Jewish state. It can be anywhere. And if you're arguing that it has to be there, why turn your back on everything else? And therefore he was a big proponent of going to Uganda. And Rav Kook took up the pen and he took on Ben Yehuda and he said, any Jew who throws away his past has no Jewish future. And it has to be only specifically the land of Israel. The religious Zionist at the time, the religious Zionism is a class unto itself. It's gone through a thousand different forms between 1903 and where we are right now. But the early days, they joined in with the Zionist movement simply as a solution to a problem. Where are we going to go? Where will we be safe? So this is a good solution. And join in. They didn't see it the way he did as a part of the redemption in the same way. And certainly the Aguda, the traditional religious community, what will become known as the Eida HaCharedis, we'll speak about in a few moments. They took that other approach of this is an imposter. This can't be, there's nothing to embrace here because there's nothing of value in front of us right now. Now Rav Kook writes in a letter in the bottom. He says, listen, one cannot altogether dismiss the success of the Zionists. He says, take a look. Again, we are living 70 years after the state. Forget about 100 years after the Balfour Declaration. We already see, like, of course this is an obvious part of the redemption process. I mean, look what's going on. Look at the fact that world Jewry now lives in the state of Israel. The center of all Torah Judaism is clear. Hands down, is now coming out of the land of Israel. It's clear that there's no future for Jews anywhere in the world outside of the land. That's clear. There's no future for us here, whether or not it's in 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, I don't know. But the future of the Jewish people is, that's obvious to us now. But it wasn't in 1930, it wasn't in 1920. But if Cook says, but look, you can't dismiss the success of the Zionists. Though this is pervaded by many deficiencies. He says, I'm not blind. It's not like I don't see them disregarding every single law of the Torah. But there also must be here a spirit of the divine to build souls for the Holy Land. It has to be. Through all, this is a beautiful quote. Through all does the Holy One, praise be He, accomplish His mission. Who can discern the mysterious working of God to fathom why there should be among those who serve this cause people who are so thoroughly tainted with heresy. I said, I don't understand. I wouldn't have mapped it out this way. The prophets didn't seem to tell us that this is what was going to happen, but it's happening. So you want to question God? This is how He's doing it. You want me to explain why it's heretics that are founding the land? I can't explain it, but I can tell you they're doing it. And therefore, how can you not see the hand of the divine telling us that this is part of a redemptive process as this is happening? Controversy number two is exactly following through. So his approach to the heretics. So I have to tell you a couple of stories. Somebody once came to him. They said to him, Rebbe, how could you join together with these people? How can you support them? Now, no one necessarily saw him on their side. The secularists saw him not necessarily on their side, and the Zionists didn't see him on their side. He was the Haredim certainly didn't. They weren't called Haredim at that time. But Reb Simcha Raz wrote a memoir of the time, and he describes somebody asking him and saying, how could you join together with them? And Rav Kook said to him, he said, what's the holiest place that ever existed amongst the Jewish people? He said, the Holy Temple. What was the holiest place within the Holy Temple? He said, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies. And who could go in there? Only the Kohen Gadol, once a year on Yom Kippur. On the holiest day, the holiest Jew, in the holiest place, that's it. Rav Kook said, how was it built? Who physically built the Holy Temple? Workmen. Workmen. With boots on their feet, and their jeans, and their work clothing, came in, and with their hammers, and their nails, they built it. And then after it was built, it was consecrated. But first you have to build, and then you consecrate. And Rav Simcha Raz writes, as he answered this question, he quoted the Gemara that says, "Banim b'chol, you build with mundane, v'achar kach mekadeshin, and then you sanctify." He said, Rav Kook leaped out of his chair, and he started to dance. And he danced around the room with that phrase, "Banim b'chol, v'achar kach mekadeshin." The Gemara says, you build with mundane, you build the Holy of Holies, and then you sanctify it. And he would dance around and he'd say, we're building the land. We're building the land. Don't you see? We're building a sanctuary. We're building the temple. It starts off mundane. And then when it's built, we're going to sanctify. He went on a trip, Rav Kook, before he got to Yerushalayim, before he was exiled from the First World War, 1913, he organized a trip. He was a Rav of Yafo, and he saw himself as the Rav of all the little towns and Yishuvim and Moshavim, everything. He saw himself as their, they didn't necessarily care or see him as their Rav, but he saw himself as the Rav of the whole area. He organized a trip in 1913. He was going to visit 36 different small little Yishuvim that were all secular, to a Kirov mission. He was going to try to bring Yiddishkeit and Judaism and try to inspire the youth of these towns. And Rav Zonnenfeld heard about it and sent a lady who wanted to join him. This is before they really got embroiled in all their controversies. So the two of them and Rav Harlap, and they were a party of about 10 people, went over several months. They visited 36 different towns to inspire the masses. Debatable whether or not it's considered successful or not. They were able to build, the numbers, I forgot, like 12 shuls, a couple of mikvos, they got a couple places to go kosher, but most places had really no interest in what they were selling, but they went. They went to a place in Merchavia. Two stories happened in Merchavia. A small little town, maybe 50, 60 Jews living in this outpost. So they told them they were coming, and so the members of the slowdown, they rented a fancy chariot to pick up these rabbanim from the train station, which was in, I forgot where it was, in Afula, which was the nearby town. But there was a lot of delays. The rabbanim couldn't get there. So delay after delay after delay. So eventually they couldn't hold on to the carriage. They didn't have the money to keep this guy. So they returned it. And then several days later, they get a telegram from the train station, the rabbanim came. So they had nothing to do. So they refurnished the manure wagon, and they cleared it out, and they threw in some straw and some pillows, and they quickly went off to the train station to pick up the rabbanim. They pick up the rabbanim, they're driving back, riding back to town, and they're apologizing profusely for their accommodations. Rav Kook, in response to his apology, I want to read. This is written up by one of the members of this place in Rechavia. Rav Kook delivered an impassioned speech, and his fiery address lasted nearly an hour. And he expressed his great joy that for the first time in his life, he was privileged to travel in a wagon owned by Jews who were building the land of Israel. And he couldn't imagine how he merited to sit in a Jewish-owned wagon that were rebuilding the land that we've yearned for 2,000 years. And here it was, the sacred history, and he gave him a history lesson of all the little towns that they were passing. And with excitement, he noted how his forefathers had lived in this place and created Jewish life. And now the descendants of those ancient Hebrews have arisen and continued their Jewish tradition. He concluded his words with a heartfelt blessing that we should merit to see with our own eyes the entire land of Israel redeemed and flourishing through the labor of the children of the eternal nation. And he gives them a whole drasha. What a merit to sit in a manure truck that's owned by Jews in the land of Israel. That's how he saw what was taking place in front of him. It happened to be while he was in Merchavia, another story took place. They were asked, Rav Kook and Rav Zonnefeld, to lead a memorial service for two Jews who had been murdered by Arabs in the weeks leading up to their visit. Just a small historical note. One of the Jews who had been killed was a Jew by the name of, this is written up by Gershon Gaffner. One of the Jews was the name Moshe Barsky. Moshe Barsky had been killed by the Arabs. He was killed while he was on a mission to get medicine from some other neighboring town for his friend Shmuel Dayan. So his friend Shmuel Dayan had gotten sick, so Moshe went to go get some medicine. He was killed by an Arab, and Rav Kook was sent, while they were there, he and Rav Zonnenfeld eulogized this Moshe Barsky. Shmuel Dayan had a son several years later, and he named him after his friend who was killed by the Arab, Moshe Dayan. Just a small historical note, and that was the person who was eulogized by Rav Kook and Rav Zonnenfeld back in 1913. And it's one of those just, nothing more needs to be said. In the box here, I don't want to read through the whole thing as we're running out of time. You'll see here several of his responses to how he approached the secular, how he saw in them. I'll just do the first paragraph on the top. Certainly one can find in every Jew, even in the lowest one, many precious jewels of good deeds and of good qualities of character beyond enumeration. And he said, Eretz Yisrael will surely help bring them out and to hallow them. And if you don't see them living here in the land, it will bring it out. And if these attributes cannot be seen in them, they'll become revealed in their children and their children's children. See, just wait. You see what you're looking at. You're just looking out that front story window. And all you see is someone who's not keeping Shabbos or Kashrus and doesn't want any Torah in their life. But I see the seeds living in the land of Israel. If not them, their children. If not their children, their children's children. Just you wait. And he wrote a response to Rabbi Yosef David the Ridvaz. It was about the Shemitah controversy, which we don't have time to go into. But he says, Your Honor, just the last paragraph, he wrote to him, Your Honor is fortunate that he's privileged to be free of the burden of public service. You're sitting in your Beis Medrash. Very nice. Yashir Kayach, from your Beis Medrash, you're telling me that this is wrong, and that's wrong, and that's not good. I am deprived. I'm burdened all day with the responsibilities of serving these people of God. And my only delight is that I remind myself that my feet are stationed on the holy soil, on the land God has called His portion and His inheritance and characterized with various expressions. So you, sitting there in Europe, yelling at me that you don't like how we're handling Shemitah, Shkoyach, come here and work with the people, building the land, bringing us back, and I take solace that I am planted firmly with my feet on the holy soil, rebuilding this land. Okay, some of the other controversies that he got became embroiled in because of his perspective on things. Focus on Torah study. So one has to remind, you know, when you think about the world today, so you know the Haredi world today, so with their secular studies, it's an old tradition. Back in 1856, a Maskil, one of the enlightened Jews from Europe, came to the land of Palestine, came to Yerushalayim, and opened up a school. 1856. And he opened up a school that was going to be of and for the Maskilim, to teach enlightened, secular Judaism without the religious concepts. Well, there was already a community in Jerusalem at the time. There were 850 religious families, traditional old Jerusalem families. And they looked at this and they said, this is treif. Get out of here. And so what they did is they couldn't actually throw him out. There was a Jew by the name of Ludwig Frankel came from 18. He was a Viennese Jew, 1856. So the 850 Jews got together and they placed a cherem, a ban in the holy city of Jerusalem. No secular studies may be taught in the holy city of Jerusalem. in response to this school being founded from the Maskilim. That ban has remained and has been seconded and reinforced and expanded since then. No secular studies. Now, there are schools in Yerushalayim that do today teach secular studies. But you have to understand that was what was in place when Rav Kook gets there in 1919 when he's invited back from London to come back to become the Rav of Yerushalayim. He sees that in place, and in his expansive, poetic mind, that was impossible. And it was part of a bigger picture that he saw that the Jewish people had to expand themselves. Not just secular studies, all aspects of Jewish scholarship. And read this quote on the bottom of page 3. As long as Orthodoxy maintains stubbornly that no, we will only study Gemara and Halacha. That's it. He says, if that's all you learn, and you don't learn Agadata, you don't learn all of the stories of the Gemara, you don't learn morals, you don't learn Musar, you don't learn Kabbalah, you don't learn research, you don't learn worldly knowledge, you don't learn Chassidus, if that's what you're going to do and leave aside all of that, then you impoverish yourself and all the strategies it adopts in self-defense without embracing the true life-giving therapy. The inner light of the Torah will prove of no efficacy. You have the tool you need to combat everything in the world. Kihem chayenu v'orech yameinu. Everything is in the Torah. But if you limit only your Gemara and your Halacha, and you miss your Musar, your philosophy, your Kabbalah, your Chassidus, your secular studies, then you're impoverishing yourself away from the inner light of the Torah. In the face of all this, I will continue my battle against all who have risen against me from all sides. Because who do you think took up arms against him when he said this? The entire yeshiva world, which is existing in Yerushalayim, which said, this is how we survived for 2,000 years. It was Gemara and Gemara and Gemara and Halacha. That's what's maintained us. And everybody else who didn't do that has fallen by the wayside. And now you're going to come and tell us to change our curriculum, to embrace philosophy, and Musar, and Chassidus, and Kabbalah, that's not our way. And he said, it is our way. And it has to be our way to combat everything that's going on in the world around us. We have the answers. You just have to give it to your children. And I will fight, he says, anybody who opposes me on this. And believe me, they did. They put him in Cherem. They said everything he's teaching is krum. It's wrong. It's crooked. It's not the way of our fathers. It's not the way of our fathers' fathers. But that's what he believed. Now, as part of his approach of sanctifying the new, so he gets into a number of other controversies. Sports. Now, sports, to our Western minds here in North America, is like no big deal. Every yeshiva that I know of plays sports. Here in the States and Canada, and it's a normal thing. Even in the Yeshiva Gedola down in Utrecht, when I went to visit for the first time, all the boys were playing hockey in the gym during their time off. And nobody looks at that and says, no, it's just, it's normal. It wasn't always that way in the religious circles. Because in Europe, and then what came over to Palestine in pre-state Israel, the religious world viewed sports as something which was totally outside the world of acceptable Jewish behavior. And when the Zionists came, they took it upon themselves as a theology, as a philosophical approach of, this is something as important to be celebrated, because we're going to be 6 feet tall and strong and blue-eyed and blonde-haired, everybody else, and we're going to be good at sports. We're going to have an Olympic team. We're going to win in judo. We're going to play our national anthem. That's part of who we are. And when are we going to play all these sports? Of course, on Shabbos, because Shabbos is not what it used to be. Shabbos is a day off, and that's when we're going to do it. So as you can imagine, the religious world looked at sports and said, treif, krum, you can't play. Not like we do today, like, listen, none of us, most Jews don't expect or want their children to grow up and be professional players. It'd be nice, it's just we're realistic about it, so we'd rather train them to own the sports team rather than play on the sports team. That's more realistic. That's how it goes. Or at least be an agent or something. So, but to play, it's a great thing. It's just a release of energy. It's good exercise. It doesn't mean anything. But in an early pre-state Israel, it did mean something. If you played sports, you were a Zionist. And if you were a Zionist, you were anti-religious. And so therefore, it was not done. And Rav Kook, in his 50th story view of the world, penned letters saying how the physical body needs to be strong and healthy. And if the physical body is strong and healthy, then it allows the spiritual soul to soar to its heights. And the beauty of sport is this national movement of the Jewish people taking it upon themselves to have a strong body so that they have a strong soul and can fulfill the will of God. And everybody looked at him and they said, "What are you talking about?" The secularists looked at him and they said, "We're not doing this to have a strong soul. We're doing this to win the Olympics." And the religious looked at him and they said, "Huh? They're playing on Shabbos on purpose. How can you like condone that? And you have this flowery, poetic idea about the beautiful body and spirit and soul. What are you talking about?" But Rav Kook saw that a healthy body leads to a healthy mind and a healthy spirit. And it's all about, but in practical terms, he couldn't find an audience to which that made sense. Similarly, the founding of Hebrew University, which was the flower of the Zionist movement to have a university that was going to take its place amongst the universities of the world and teach, which was the big issue, Bible criticism. So here you have this idea. The religious community said, "You're going to have a university that's going to teach Bible criticism in the land of Israel, trying to prove that we're actually not divine and not special and we have no connection to this land. How can you have a university in the land of Israel that teaches Bible criticism?" So they invited when they opened it. This is Weitzman's big idea. Rav Kook got from Chaim Weitzman a promise that they would not teach Bible criticism in Hebrew University. And with that promise, he agreed to speak at its inaugural opening. Weitzman, whether or not because he never meant it or because he wasn't able to carry it through, was not able to fulfill that promise. And of course, there was Bible criticism at the Hebrew University. And Rav Kook spoke at the opening, and he basically made nobody happy. He spoke because the religious community could not believe that in the land of Israel, the land of the yeshivas, the land of Torah, we are now going to have a university that's going to be teaching Bible criticism. And he spoke again in the same flowery terminology about how this was going to be the flowering of the Jewish mind, that it was going to bring, it had to be pious teachers teaching our Jewish youth the ways of our fathers. And the secularists are like, what university does he think he's talking at? They were not going to have pious individuals teaching the courses. That wasn't their plan. And he was, again, an individual who had a vision that wasn't shared by any of the people on any of the sides around him, what it was that he saw as far as the practice around him. A brief word on Karbanos. He actually believed, Rav Kook did, that the Adam HaRishon was a vegetarian. Noach, after saving all the animals, was permitted to kill and eat animal flesh. And Rav Kook understood, based on various sources, that was because of the lowly nature that man had sunk to. In order to distinguish him from the animal world, he was now given permission to kill and eat the animal world, because he had fallen so low that became a way he needed to like distinguish himself. But that in the times of the Mashiach, when the redemption will be complete, it will become again repulsive to mankind to eat the flesh of another living being. Just something that, it won't be that the laws will change, it will just be intrinsically repulsive. Like, how could you eat flesh of a living creature? And that the korbanot will still exist, but not in a form that we will eat them. And that's the progression of mankind will revert back to the state of mankind pre-flood. It's reported that he was a vegetarian, except for Shabbos, he ate chicken. It was reported as far as his own personal haggah. I can't vouch one way or the other, but that's what's said. Chief Rabbinate, this was the big issue, which really leads to where we are today. In 1919, he was invited again to serve as the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, and then to become the chief rabbi of all of the land of Israel. Again, this is pre-state. Now, the WZO, the World Zionist Army, was not a religious organization, but they wanted to have a chief rabbi. They wanted to be a state, it wasn't yet a state, but an official position representing the Jewish people, and would oversee religious life. Now, the religious community that was there vehemently opposed this position, the concept of a chief rabbi. Not every country has a chief rabbi. I do not believe there's a chief rabbi here in Canada, right? There's certainly not one in the States. They opposed it. They opposed it on several grounds. Number one, they opposed it because the WZO, the British, nobody had the authority to appoint. Who granted them the authority to appoint this guy as the chief rabbi? You can't just do that. Number two, he's not qualified to be the chief rabbi, not because he wasn't a scholar, but because he had all of these radical understandings and positions that the religious community at the time vehemently disagreed with. And number three, philosophically, it's nothing to be appointed. There's no such thing as appointing it. What is the chief rabbi? They believe, philosophically, it's a hierarchy. Every shul has a rav. Fine. The rav answers the questions for the people of his community. When the rav doesn't know an answer, what does he do? I don't know something. Whatever. So I call my rav. If that rav doesn't know whatever it is that I'm asking, what does he do? Calls his rav. Well, what does that rav do? At some point, you hit the top of the pyramid. That's your chief rabbi. Not because he was appointed, not because there was a vote, because he is. He simply is the recognized source of the top of the pyramid, the final stop. That's the person we ask our questions to, and nobody above him. When he says this, that's it. And there have been times in our history where that's how it goes. So they oppose this concept of a chief rabbi. What do you mean he's appointed? It's not a political position that you run for, and your placards are all over town, vote for me, chief rabbi. It doesn't work that way. It's a measure of a meritocracy. You earn it through a lifetime where people recognize you as intrinsically. That's who you are. So the religious community vehemently opposed the position. Rav Kook accepted the position after a couple of years of back and forth. In 1921, he accepted the position of the chief rabbi. When he did, Rav Zonnenfeld and the religious Jews of Yerushalayim immediately didn't accept it and formed their own Beis Din, their own court of law, to oversee gittin and kiddushin, marriages and divorces and conversions, and it was called the Eidah Charedis, and that is the start of what we have today of the state-sponsored rabbinate, the Rabbanut, the Ashkenazi and Sephardi chief rabbi of Israel, and then you have the Eidah Charedis, you have the Haredi world out of Mea Shearim that doesn't accept the authority of that entire position and does their own thing. And when did that start? Started in 1921, 25 years prior to the state, the modern state of Israel, when Rav Kook, we all refer to him as the first chief rabbi of Israel. Well, he was 25 years before the state, but when he was appointed by the British and by the WZO as the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the land of Palestine, the Eidah Charedis and Rav Zonnenfeld immediately broke off and started their own Eidah Charedis group, and that has maintained itself until today. It needs to be noted, I didn't really get into the back and forth. Zonnenfeld and Rav Kook themselves had a very close personal relationship. Their story is a paradigm of Jewish history in so many ways. They had many interactions. They were the two chief rabbis of Jerusalem. They were at every bris together. Rav Kook was the Kohen. Rav Zonnenfeld was 25 years his senior, and 20 years his senior, and a venerable Talmud Chacham, the leader of the community. They themselves had many, many interactions. They're in many pictures together. Each side had a bunch of zealots, as we'll call them. And they would put up posters all over the place, and they would kick up a firestorm all the time. They made things personal. They would bash each other. I have one pamphlet printed here on the top of page 4. This rebel, referring to Rav Kook, is excommunicated on the basis of his teaching of the sages. It is forbidden to stand before him, to study Torah from him. It's a mitzvah to show disdain for him. And whoever supports him is as one who plants a tree for idol worship close to the altar of God. They were personal attacks, and they were vicious, and it was always from the zealots. The two at the top had a tremendous respect for each other. Rav Kook, there's a story that Rav Zonnenfeld's grandson was sent to Rav Kook to deliver a message. Shmuel Hillel Schenker, who was Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld's son-in-law, received a note from Chaim Ozer Gradansky, who's one of the leading sages of Europe, that required the attention of Rav Kook. So Rav Zonnenfeld's son-in-law sent his son, Rav Zonnenfeld's grandson, to Rav Kook with a telegram. And he comes into Rav Kook's apartment, and Rav Kook is surrounded by a group of supporters, and this young yeshiva bacher is like in enemy territory and totally overwhelmed by the scene. So Rav Kook sees him, takes him in. He's told that this is Rav Zonnenfeld's grandson with a message. He pulls him off into a side room. He takes a look at the telegram. And then He takes his hand and blesses the boy with unusual warmth. Sensing his discomfort, and he held the youth's trembling hand, walks him to a side room, turns to him and smiles and says, he shows him the certificates of ordination from the world's greatest Torah authorities and the letters addressed to me. He says, "You'll realize that I'm not the person that they say about me." Parenthetically, he was once walking by himself at night. And somebody came up to him and said, "You know, it says in the Gemara that a Talmud Chacham shouldn't walk alone lest he be attacked by Shadim, by demons." That's a statement in the Gemara. So a Bacher came up to Rav Kook, the venerable, and he said, "Rebbe, you shouldn't walk by yourself, because the Gemara says that Talmud Chacham might be attacked by demons." So Rav Kook says, he said, "The demons in this city don't think that I'm a Talmud Chacham." So he says to this Bacher, he says to the grandson of Rav Zonnenfeld, he says, "I give you my absolute word that in our innermost hearts, your grandfather of Yosef Chaim and myself are intimate friends. I also give you my absolute word that if your grandfather were on the other side of the Simbatyon River, a mystical Talmudic place, I would spare no sacrifice him to bring him over here safely. And the reason why I can associate with the leftists and with the irreligious is only because there's a tzaddik like Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld who stands and admonishes and chides and remonstrates. That's why I can be close to them and they can feel close to me. But I just want you to know, my dear Bacher, if your grandfather, Rabbi Yosef Chaim, did not do what he does to protest as strongly as he does, then I would have to do what he does and protest as strongly as he." I'll conclude, it's late, I'll conclude with his last letter. He got sick and he died from cancer in 1935. The very last letter, there's so much more. Marc Chagall met him in 1931. He was traveling through Palestine, and he wanted to paint his portrait. And Rav Kook demurred. He said, of what benefit to the Jewish people is it? So he refused. And Chagall was recorded to have remarked on his way out, he said, "Where do you find such a holy face like that from? Where do you get such a holy face?" His final letter, this book, if you're interested, Yehuda Mirsky wrote a book on Rav Kook, A Mystic in a Time of Revolution. Awesome. A phenomenal, if you want an insight into the day and the age and the era, phenomenal, phenomenal book. I highly, highly recommend it if this is of this time frame is of interest to you. This is his final letter that he wrote before he died. He was literally writing this on his deathbed. The introduction is in the summer before he died, in response to violent clashes between the left and right wing activists in Haifa. He wrote one last open letter, title taken from Yirmiyahu, another from the prophet Jeremiah, "For the Shattering of My People," a phrase that Jeremiah says, "For the Shattering of My People." His letter says as follows, quote, "From my fount of tears, which I cannot stop," this is from his deathbed, "I call to you, my brothers, each one a seal upon my heart, no matter your party. I don't know who is to blame, better to say we are all to blame. What has become of us? And now, House of Israel, my holy name defile no longer," quoting a pasuk from Yechezkel Anavi, "lay aside anger, learn to look at each other, party to party, with the eyes of compassionate brothers cast together into great trouble, willing to unite for one sacred goal, the common goal, its dignity and sacred service, to return and to live, dear wounded brothers. Signed, your faithful servant, broken and shattered, awaiting speedy redemption for the prisoners of hope." And it was, in a way, an appropriate final letter. It was a tragic life in which I did not even do justice at all. I'm aware of that, of who he was, the greatness, the complexity of his soul, the poetry. But he was alone on the 50th floor, and nobody else occupied that place. And the way he saw the development of the land, he was at odds. They burned his books in the streets. They banished him. They put him in Cherem. I read only a few of the things that were said about him, of total disregard, because he said things that they couldn't understand. This flowering of the redemption with this irreligious people, the religious community were just trying to maintain Shabbos and Kashrus and Mikvah and Yeshiva, and they were a threat, the religious Zionists, the Zionists. And he kept embracing them because he saw in them holiness, and nobody else did. And I'm not here right or wrong. If I lived in that era, I don't know what I would say. Now, I view myself as a tremendous student of... I'm just so taken by his philosophy and what he presented and what he saw. But again, boots on the ground, they couldn't live by what he said. It just didn't make sense to anyone. And he describes in letters that it's too much to read, the frustration of the soul of a poet who cannot express itself. It's sad to read his poetry of this frustrated existence. There is no way that he would have ever believed, if you would have told him that it would be 2017 and the redemption had not yet come, that it would still be the fractitious nature of the Jewish people. We'll be halfway there, half of the Jewish people, but it's not there. There's no way he would have believed you. No way. It's 80 years? No way 100 years would go by from the Balfour Declaration and there still would be Jews in Montreal. No way. He'd say, impossible. We're on the footsteps of redemption. And he might be right, but we're still at the footsteps. We're moving, and it's clear. When you look back over the last 60 years, it's unbelievable, the miraculous nature of what the land and the state of Israel has accomplished. But we're not there yet. He wouldn't believe it. Yeah, before the Holocaust. So in his worldview, I think nobody could have believed it, but in his worldview, he would say, that's the seed in the ground that has to be totally disintegrated to flower up. I mean, in hindsight, I don't think no one would dare say that. You know, again, when we spoke about the Holocaust before, the Zionists said the Holocaust was because nobody moved to Israel, and the religious said it was because people moved to Israel. Who's right? You know, we don't have a prophet, so nobody knows. We're looking back. And we can see that Cookian philosophy of, yeah, maybe that was the husk being totally just dismantled in order to flower out. But I don't know. Without a prophet, I'm conjecturing. I'm imagining that's what he would say, but he died in 35 before the happening. Anyway, there's a tip of the iceberg of his philosophy, a tip of the iceberg. But the roots of what we have today between the Haredim and the modern religious Zionist community are rooted in this, and it just continued on for a century, almost, literally, still until today. And again, I didn't do any of it justice, but just to whet your appetite a little bit, if it's of interest, we'll cover some of the Lechi and the Irgun and the Haganah Meretz Hashem next Monday night, fighting not for the soul of the land, but for the people and the security of the land, how the controversy of how to go about that particular battle, Meretz Hashem next week. Let's dive in Ma'ariv in 1 minute for those who are interested. Have a wonderful night and look forward to seeing you next week.